Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. This is episode 19. I'm Wade Wojcik, your host, joined by David Ishida.
Hello.
Ben Robertson.
Hello.
And Kellen Berg back with us again.
Hey, what's up, dogs?
You joined us for episode 3, talking about screenwriting software and screenwriting technique. Back again. We're going to, well, first of all, I should just say, we just spent the last 3 hours of our life immersed in a great movie that I requested we watch for this episode, which is Armageddon.
And all of us hate you for it. Yeah. And we will never let you forget this.
I'm okay with it.
America thanks you.
Michael Bay's 1998 classic.
Classic is a very strong word.
I wanted to watch it because it came on when I was just skimming through channels a few weeks ago. So I wanted to watch it and kind of tie it into the rest of the things we're talking about today. So kicking off, I wanted to talk about, for Tools of the Trade, something we haven't touched on yet, but would be really interesting, and that is CGI software, specifically free ones. So this is going to be if you need a 3D model of like a set extension or a spaceship or whatever, something that's not physically there, composite it into your shot. I know we're kind of jumping because we haven't really talked about compositing in this show yet either, but...
We haven't.
But this kind of ties into spaceships and Armageddon. So I'm going to make this real quick because we just want to dive into Armageddon. But basically... Blender is the free open source 3D modeling, animating, rendering software that, David, you've used quite a bit, right?
I have, yes. And it is incredibly capable for being free. Mm-hmm. If you go to professional studios and whatnot, yes, they're going to be using Maya and 3ds Max and other high-end systems like that. But you can do some incredible things with Blender for being free. And there's all sorts of great examples. I know every year they do like a movie, like an animated movie that was all done in Blender. Everything, the animation, the texturing, the lighting. And they look very, very good. Like, they look cinema quality. So you are really getting a lot for... literally nothing.
Yeah, and they have a great online community too. They have forums and competitions, I think,
yep.
Yearly where they have films that people produce solely in Blender.
Yep, and you can, and one of the great things about it is it is a complicated program to learn. Like, I have on many occasions I learned to do different things in it. It takes a while to learn it. But there are so many fantastic resources in tutorials. If you search Blender tutorial on YouTube, you will get 100,000 different options, most of them probably being pretty damn good.
Yeah.
Teaching you how to go through things in a very simple step-by-step way.
It would seem like that's one of the benefits of Blender. Like, you would think that, like, it's a free application. It's not going to, like, necessarily be as good as, like, as you were saying, David, like Maya and the other applications that exist out there. But one of the things I consistently hear brought up by people who use it is the community that exists for Blender. There's a lot of passionate people that do work in Blender, that use Blender, and that are willing to go out of their way to make good content that helps others also use Blender.
Yeah, and the software is getting better all the time, too. They're adding more and more features that make it more capable and on par with some professional mm-hmm. software or you know, expensive software. And our friend Lee, who we've worked with on a lot of projects, he's used Blender since high school, so it's been around for, oh god, like at least 15 years. It's old software at this point.
Yeah,
yeah, it looks like it was developed in 1995 by Dutch animation studio Neo Geo. It also functions as a game engine.
Yes.
Which I did forget about. Back in high school, Lee did this, it was a project for geography or government or whatever, where you had to make a town, and so he made his town in Blender and had a car where he could drive around it. It's pretty advanced for high school.
Wow, that is impressive stuff right there.
So the first time I heard about Maya was back in high school when I played a lot of Halo 2, and I learned that they made Halo in Maya. And so I kind of always saw it as this really intimidating piece of software, mm-hmm. you know, because the learning curve is so steep. But about a year or two ago, I decided to just dive in and see if I could learn how to use it. It's a slog. It's a really hard thing to learn, as I'm sure you know with Blender.
Yeah.
But you know, you kind of take it in chunks, take it in bites. I don't do anything with modeling. Lee is a great modeler, but I just get the models online. I acquire them.
Right.
And then I take it from there.
And it is, because as I recall, Maya is owned by Autodesk.
Yes.
Who makes other software such as CAD, which is AutoCAD, which is the premier drafting software for computer aided drafting. And I believe with them, because I think when I was in college, I did also got it as well. And you should check on this. But for a time, you could get it for free if you were a student.
You still can.
Oh, you still can. Okay, cool. Yeah. So that's a cool thing if people are wanting to try it. You know, a lot of the core concepts would transfer over from Blender.
Yeah.
You know, the core of how you make things and navigate in the world is pretty much the same. It's just getting used to a different UI.
And
so do you feel that going with Blender still, like, it better preps you for going into something like Maya?
I think it, for a lot of people, it would be a good option because it is so capable.
Sure.
For being a free software, and especially since, like, obviously there's some ways you can cheat the system, which we will not condone on this podcast, of continuing to keep Maya after you are no longer a student. But, you know, that is, I don't know, it's probably like $1,000 seat program. It's not a cheap program.
It's more.
So it may be more worth it because you are probably able to do just as much in Blender. I would probably recommend that you, like, just go all in on Blender, and then, you know, if the opportunities arise, to spend some time in Maya.
Yeah, I think it's a subscription base now, which is even worse.
Oh, everybody. I hate that.
But, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of one of those things I would recommend, yeah, picking or choosing. I wouldn't say one leads to the other necessarily. While you're learning the fundamentals of, you know, modeling and animation, those sorts of things, the interfaces are drastically different, and the controls are very different. So me being more fluent with Maya, I look open Blender, I have no idea like how to navigate it. It's just so different. And with Lee and probably you as well, David, it's vice versa. Another thing I would probably add there is it's best to, you know, you kind of get into Maya or Blender and you are interested in modeling or
animation
or rigging. It's best if you want to like be serious about one of those to focus on one area because they're so specialized.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that we come across when we do work with Don is, you know, like Lee is great at modeling and has been doing it for a long time, but then the whole act of texturing, of putting the textures on models, is this whole other process of UV mapping and then finding texture files and then laying them out to a 2D flat version of it, and it's this huge other process.
Right. And lighting and getting, basically it's this never-ending struggle to make what you're doing photoreal or photorealistic.
Yeah, if that's what you're going for,
of course. Right, absolutely. So the thing we're doing with Don is we're using both Maya and Blender. I'm using Maya, and Lee and David are using Blender. And we're all trying to get like a photorealistic look, you know, with the shaders, the materials, the lighting, all that sorts of things. And basically what we're trying to do is make it look as good or better than a miniature. Because at one point in Don, we had someone, I think it was one of Sean's military friends, who could possibly build a pelican, a miniature model pelican for us.
And before that even, I was going to potentially make the Dawn itself.
Oh, that's right.
It was a very short-lived conversation because at the time, we had started looking into it, but at the time, we did not have access to high enough quality 3D models of the ship to be able to reasonably make the model, because we were going to be going off of a 3D one and then basically doing almost a Pepakura thing on it, and we didn't like the depth and the amount of time to do that warranted. Well, we'll just wait.
I remember you were also going to make an arm, a camera arm, a Steadicam arm.
Yeah, that's I have that in a drawer in my house. I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah. So
a lot of ideas that we're had.
But those are both really good options if you are interested in putting some cool things in your scene. We'll cover compositing in another episode. I just wanted to kind of throw those out there as viable options and combine it with, we can just dive right into tricks of the trade because we're kind of combining these two, shooting with miniatures, the kind of polar opposite of using CG.
Sorry.
Someone's moved around in a chair.
Sorry, I'm readjusting. I didn't think it would sound like an elephant.
Are you wearing leather pants right now?
Chaps.
So,
Chaps.
Good.
So Armageddon came out in 1998 and Apollo 13.
95, I think.
Earlier. Significantly 96. Earlier.
96. We should find out.
I'm going to find out.
All right, Kellen's on it.
Tell me you don't just know, Kellen.
He knows the actors in it.
I'm pretty sure. My first thing was it was 95. It might be 94.
I think it's 96.
Regardless, it came out before, and I think a lot of inspiration was given to the makers of Armageddon. But the
95.
95, so three years. And one thing that I think is so interesting is the successful use of models in Apollo 13. And before that, space films like 2001 Space Odyssey, where it looks, for the time at least, you know, in the use of miniatures, photorealistic, or even Star Wars. You got countless examples. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Armageddon, which is a fucking shit show.
Yeah.
So it, I just wanted to, well, go ahead, David.
Oh yeah, I was going to say, because I feel like around this time of Armageddon is when we started to see in actual big budget blockbuster movies, this shift start to happen, and fewer miniatures were being used sort of from about that point on. And don't get me wrong, the movies did use miniatures after that, Lord of the Rings being one of the biggest ones that still did miniatures.
Phantom Menace too.
Yeah, exactly, and Phantom Menace. There were other movies that did it, but I feel like this was really the tipping point when people really started to shift over to CGI. Mm-hmm. Just from a, I don't know, it was probably initially anyway, it was probably a cost-saving thing because the, you know, just spending the money to have someone spend, you know, 50 hours working on, you know, creating a model or whatever was probably a lot cheaper than buying the materials and all the craftsmen to do a miniature.
Yeah, I feel like there was an overzealous stage of maybe 5 to 10 years where filmmakers thought they could do more than they could with CG.
Yeah.
A film like Gladiator, which I think was 2001, I want to say, used CG sparingly. 2000? It was actually. I think you're right. It was 2000. Anyway, around the same time, the CG effects were used sparingly and tastefully to do things like set extensions or, mm-hmm. you know, things that would blend in. But there were other films like Armageddon or the Matrix sequels that were so obsessed with what they could, with what CG enabled them to do, they sacrificed the photorealism because the technology wasn't there yet.
It was like the use of CGI as being supplementative versus complementative.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and someone in the special features for Lord of the Rings, that someone makes a really good comment about it. There's a scene in the Return of the King during the fight in Asgiliath in the Two Towers, when a boulder gets thrown from a catapult and hits a tower in Asgiliath and crumbles. And originally that was going to be a CGI shot. And then they're like, well, we have the tower and we have big fake hunks of rubble. Let's just do it. And so they did it. They did it for real and they shot it at the tower and it crumbles. And they're saying that how much better that looked as a model because of the amount of time and effort to get all the dust particles and the debris and all that stuff falling correctly in the shot would have been ridiculous compared to a shot that, you know, it was a 30-second shot or whatever, probably took them a day or two to prepare, mm-hmm. but then it was all in camera and then just moved on.
Well, I'm sure, like, to a degree, especially, like, now, there are certain things that are definitely easier to do in post with, like, CGI versus doing it in frame with a miniature. Like I remember there was a behind-the-scenes thing talking about, like, Star Trek Next Generation, how they were talking about, like, all the models they had to do for the Enterprise and all the various ships in there and how it was, like it was a big deal and how they have to film a certain way and, like, getting all the miniatures the right way, whereas, like, with now, like, you just build a model and you just throw it in post. Like, granted, different times, but there's something to be said that, like, using whichever one is best for your application in the very end is... I mean, I feel like this is the way.
I mean, ultimately, if you can fool the eye, then that's your goal. It doesn't matter if it's miniature or CG. Yeah. It's about photorealism. And with the shot you mentioned, I know exactly the shot because it's a great shot and works really well. So one thing that helps you if you want to shoot with miniatures is the equation for the frame rate you're supposed to shoot
Very
at.
Very important.
So basically, the idea is you need to shoot at a higher frame rate relative to the size of what you're shooting because... If you've probably noticed this, if you tried this, you know, I did it when I was younger making movies.
Everybody has.
Yeah. If you film something pretending it to be big, but of course you're doing it at a normal frame rate, so it doesn't. It looks small. Mm-hmm. So what the equation is 24 times the square root of the big object divided by the small object. So basically, you know, if your ratio is...
If you're doing a 1/16th scale model, and the actual object is, you know, 32 feet long,
so that would be it'd be 16/1, so it'd be the square root of 16, which is 4 times 24. That's basically the idea, and so that way when it's played back at 24, it's slowed down, but that's because something that big would, you know, move that.
Yeah, it's giving an object mass in a certain sense, but you know, obviously not physical mass, but it gives us this mass on screen.
Yeah.
That works. I know we did some tests actually when we were still potentially going to shoot with a Pelican with a high speed camera because one issue you could run into is if you like the Pelican, which is 100 foot long, is it?
Yeah, it's about 100 feet.
Yeah, a Pelican is, and the model we were going to have would have been like a 44th scale or 44th or 77th scale is what the model would have been. And to give that the right, because of how drastic that size difference was, we were going to need to shoot at like 300 or 400 frames per second, I think, to get the mass right. So you know that's a big challenge that you could run into is what is paying attention to the scale you make it in versus the scale of the object.
And with that frame rate, with that frame rate too, you have to make sure you're shooting it with a lot of light.
Yeah, then there's a whole host of other options of dealing with that. Whereas, you know, though this would have been a crazy thing, if we were able to shoot it at a 16th or an 8th scale, then the frame rate would be very, very reasonable.
Yeah, absolutely. So then, things to keep in mind with shooting with miniatures is one technique is forced perspective. And we've talked, you know, off podcast a lot about the Lord of the Rings examples with the Hobbits. But there was one that I saw. Have you guys seen The Wolf of Wall Street?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So... well, anyway,
you've seen Armageddon, but you haven't seen Wall Street.
Anyway, so there's a scene on a yacht where he's got the helicopter, you know, on the top of the yacht.
Yeah.
The helicopter is a model, like an actual physical, you know, helicopter model, and they basically filmed it from the same perspective, like top down, as the shot on the yacht, and then they just were able to composite it in convincingly. I thought I didn't know it was a model seeing the film. Mm. So I think one example for doing a model as opposed to CG is if it doesn't cost very much, like buying a model at a store, it looks photoreal and it just has that kind of granular quality that a CG model just doesn't have yet. Like you mentioned, the Asgiliath one, the dust added, you know, stuff to it.
And there's another thing you had mentioned, I don't remember where your source was or if this is just a thought you had, but I think it was about Lord of the Rings as well. But the other thing to consider when you're making something in CG is you have to account for everything. You have to account for the light sources. You have to account for the dust on it and, you know, creating all of that stuff in CG. Whereas if you were to film a model, one, you know, life is a little easier because the light is what the light is. You know, you can put the light, you can twist it more easily, and sometimes happy accidents happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you could have it and, oh my gosh, the light hit it in a completely unexpected way, and you got this perfect glint off the chrome of your little model car that happy accident would have never happened in a CG because that physically couldn't happen.
Yeah, there's more room to play around with that.
Yeah.
Because ultimately everything you're doing in CG you have to think of. It comes from your imagination.
Right.
However, though, I will say, having done a shot yesterday in Maya, one thing that I love about it is it's so accessible. You don't need to build, you know, a spaceship. You can just plop a model in and immediately start playing around with angles and stuff. So it's good for previs, if nothing else.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then the other thing I wanted to talk about for shooting with miniatures was set extensions. So Blade Runner does this a lot. They extend the set with miniatures.
Yep.
Also Star Wars.
Or Matt Pattinson's as well. It's an older style of doing that.
Right, in the original, they use Matt Pattinson's a lot. And we'll cover more of that when we talk about compositing in a different episode. But I just want to touch on, those examples, but also the Star Wars prequels used... miniatures, a lot of them, for set extensions that don't look like miniatures. You think they're CG.
Three of them?
Yeah, there's a lot more than people give it credit for. Everyone thinks of them as a CGI fun fest, as I call it.
So you know the cloning facility on Kamino where it looks white and fake?
Yeah.
So that, a lot of that, it's a miniature.
Yep. They were shot on
like
a green screen.
Shots?
No,
the interior.
The interior when he's walking through like the white.
They were shot on a green screen, so they weren't in a real place or anything. But the space itself is a miniature.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's also another interesting one that can happen.
Thanks, Matt.
So they are good.
That's, you know, Kellen raises a good point. It doesn't matter how much craftsmanship goes into a piece if the audience doesn't care.
Yeah. Yep.
Story.
All the stormtroopers were not real though.
Another little.
What? That's true. We're not giving the Star Wars prequels a pass. I just think it's so interesting to see all the craftsmanship that went into it unnoticed, apparently.
Certainly true. Yes. Absolutely true.
There's another little happy accident that can happen with miniatures, again from Lord of the Rings, because I know a little lot about the production of Lord of the Rings. When they were making the Tower of Minas Morgul,
Minas Tirith?
I'm forgetting. With the courtyards, the square courtyards at off angles to each other, with that Frodo is captured in the not Cirith Ungol.
Yeah, that is Cirith
Ungol. Is that Cirith Ungol? Yeah. What am I thinking of the other one?
I don't know.
Anyway, okay, so Cirith Ungol. they made this miniature, and what they were able to do is because they were shooting a scene with Frodo with the Shelob on a set, and they just had a green screen like Horizon. But what they were able to do for one of the first times is the scale worked out that they just took the miniature and rolled it down for an eye line for the actors, that they could actually look down the pass and, oh, there it is, and it's correct. And they were actually able to do that in camera for real, give them a real eye line.
So I brought up Wolf of Wall Street. Scorsese loves to do practical miniature sextensions and models. Another example is Shutter Island. You guys seen Shutter Island?
Yep.
Nope.
What? Kellen, you can back me up on this.
You've seen Armageddon.
So the Ward C, the Civil War fortress, that's a miniature.
In
Shutter Island.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I don't remember that. So I can't back you up. I'm sorry.
You've seen Armageddon.
No, you don't remember Shutter Island? Oh,
man. Basically, they did a lot of little tweaks to the image that that are, like Ben, you brought up, they're complimentary. Mm-hmm. So they just add flavor to it. They're not like necessarily the subject unless it's Ward C. That you'd never think. So they can like, they shoot a bunch of guys on a green screen and then they throw them way back on top of buildings.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or also the lighthouse in Shutter Island. That's a miniature. And
whoa.
Yeah. Or for most of it, it's a miniature. Like the final shot of the film when they are on the beach and they look at the lighthouse. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a miniature. And it's all done in camera.
That's
like
really
no
cool.
Post.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did it really convincingly where they were able to show it from like 10 feet away, but it looked like a full-scale lighthouse. Wow. But again, you know, just make sure you're following the formula. Use it as a guideline. Because mm-hmm. like, I don't know, like in Pacific Rim, if one of the giant mech dudes falls over, if he falls over at the speed of a person falling over, it's going to look, you know, totally fake. Mm-hmm. So he's got to, you know, fall slowly, have that mass
right.
to it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'd love to keep going into this and talk about compositing, but we've got much bigger fish to fry in this podcast. So
you mean much bigger meteors to fry?
It was an asteroid.
Asteroids
so,
to fry.
I'll fry your asteroid.
I beg your pardon, sir.
We'll be right back and talk about Armageddon. So we watched Armageddon. Guys, initial thoughts.
It's actually still really overwhelming to me to watch. I remember seeing it the first time in a theater, and I was overwhelmed then. And then watching this, I'm like, oh my God, when does it stop?
Yeah.
I think you're doing it wrong if you're watching this movie sober. I think you need.
Yeah. See, the mistake we had was we had a really heavy sipper beer. We should have had the chugging beer.
Yeah, we should have. Like a good
Natty
like
Light.
Hams or
Natty Ice.
Some sort of like American hams. Shit beer.
Yeah. We needed the Armageddon.
That's what this
of
movie
beers.
Demands.
So Kellen, you're absolutely right. It's overwhelming. It's the longest action montage ever.
It's the hardest, hardworking action montage.
Yeah. Cause like the first half of the film is these fucking oil drillers preparing to be astronauts. So Bruce Willis is an oil driller, and then NASA brings him in. They're like, we need to train our astronauts how to drill. And he looks at him and he goes, I'll do it, but I need to bring my own team. Done.
Yeah, that was like the best part. I was like, wait, so you're just throwing this entire plan out, and these guys are standing there, and I'm sure after that they were like, and we're not doing this job anymore?
Yeah.
They hired oil drillers?
Yeah, they're standing there all cross-armed like, yeah, we're the
no
guys.
No offense to oil drillers. None at all. And I'm sure it's a very difficult job, and there are many,
God,
many
yeah.
challenges. When I think of the skill it takes to become an astronaut versus the skill it takes to become a oil driller, no offense, but I'm pretty sure it's aired in the astronaut's favor.
But Bruce Willis showed that they don't know jack about drilling.
Yeah, it's a science. It's an art.
No, he said it's not a science. It's an
oh.
art. But Dave, what did you think about the movie? We didn't.
No.
Hear what you thought?
No. No.
Just no. So you made a joke when we were filming towards the end, and some of the, well, what they would think is the higher pace bit, and you made the joke because I would say after seeing Dunkirk, of like, who knew that a film can keep your heart rate above 150 beats per minute for 2 hours?
They
straight.
Did it in 1998.
And so
Michael
he
Bay.
Said that. So he said, hey, how's your heart rate after this one? So I said, I'll check. I looked at my Apple Watch, and it was lower than my resting heart rate.
74?
Yeah, 74. I just don't care.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many moments in this of character development that is, completely unbelievable. Like, not like crazy, it's just you can't believe it. Like there's mm-hmm. a whole thing at the very end, spoiler alert, when Bruce Willis says like to AJ, Ben Affleck's character, like, I always thought of you as a son, and I'd be honored if you'd marry my daughter. And nowhere else in the entire movie do we have any reason to believe
it. He internalizes it. That's why the reveal makes so much more sense. Right. Or it impacts it so much more.
I mean, like, AJ's supposed to be, like, a young version of, like, Bruce Willis's character, right? I mean, they allude to that at the very beginning. So, like, naturally, he feels that he himself is a good, like, person for his daughter. So, like, maybe, I don't
know. Yeah. Well, maybe Bruce Willis's character didn't like himself when he was that age. Like, he looks back at himself, he's like, I was an asshole. So, he's, like, taking it out on Ben Affleck's character.
Yeah.
It's deep. It's rich, David. This movie's so rich.
How can you be
it's
so
got
heartless?
So much going on.
I can't even joke about so, that. That's how badly I think it is. I don't know. No.
The thing that baffled me the most about this movie initially was
the one thing.
utter lack of scientific accuracy in this film. The things they do. So, like, you take a film like Interstellar, where they, like, painstakingly went and got details nailed down that would make sense.
Yes.
For example, the Endurance spins to provide artificial gravity. The Endurance is shaped, you know, in a circle. So the rooms, yeah. You know, this so that makes sense.
Yeah.
In this movie, you've got a Russian space station.
With American flag inside.
Yeah. That is shaped like normal space station, like, you know, not...
Like Mir or the International Space
Station. It's just a bunch series of tubes that are just kind of linked together. And then they're like, it's going to start spinning so we can get gravity. What? But then, okay. But the best part is they start spinning the station and then two shuttles attach to it while it's spinning on the outer edges of its spin.
Yes.
I mean, I naturally think that when you look at movies from Christopher Nolan and Michael Bay, you're going to get drastically different results.
Yeah. It's just like Michael Bay, like, saw this, like, in Previz or whatever, and he's like, yeah, this makes sense. We're doing that.
You know, it is funny though, because like there are a lot of like shots in this movie that I swear were like exact shots that he used in Transformers.
Probably.
Like I'd be curious to research that everything, more. Even like the color. Like I swear. Like,
oh yeah.
I wonder if this is like a shot that he maybe didn't get during principal in Transformers. He's like, you know what? Gotcha, guys. We got some spare footage of Armageddon in the back. They were shit blowing
Michael
up
Bay
in
and
York.
And also, I think it's also worth saying that there is an untold truth in this film, and that is in reality. Every single car on the planet and every single building on the planet is sitting on 25 gas tanks of gasoline and 200 pounds of dynamite.
Ready to blow
every
up
one of them,
at any time.
Every one of them is full.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know. I have it in my car. You, Kellen?
My whole trunk is basically just gasoline. It's just a drum of gasoline.
Okay. Well, one thing that I loved before we even approached this movie months ago, Neil deGrasse Tyson tweeted that, or not, maybe it wasn't a tweet, but he like made reference to how the plan that NASA enacts to avoid this asteroid threat is completely ridiculous and would never work.
Right.
Because it would not, their plan was to drill into the center of the asteroid, put a nuke, blow it up, and split the asteroid in two neat little pieces that would fly on either side of Earth.
Yes.
But Neil deGrasse Tyson said if you did that, it would just blow it up into many pieces that would still hit Earth.
Yes. Yes. Someone made this analogy, and I'm not at all trying to compare this in any way to Star Wars. I think it was actually also Neil deGrasse Tyson who was asked to compare Star Wars and Star Trek and what he thought of them. And he said Star Wars is science fantasy, where they don't explain how every little thing works. It's just the X-Wings have engines, they light up, and you go. That's it. Star Trek is science fiction. They do care about explaining and showing how things work and why they work they do. This is science fantasy. This is not sci-fi, this film. This is science fantasy.
And it's still sort of bad science fantasy.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's all unbelievable.
It seems like, so I'm looking back at like, it seems like a 1930s, like Indiana Jones, like a serial.
Yeah.
Like it seems like that and they're like.
Like Flash Gordon or something.
Yeah, we're going to expand on it a little bit because it's totally unbelievable. And then it just works. Like I know it's a ridiculous movie, but watching it, it was a highly calculated marketing.
Oh, yeah.
They were just like, we're going to make so much money off
yeah.
this.
Yeah. And what is the box office on this film?
Oh, God.
And something that I actually... Maybe in like another 5 years when I'm ready to watch this film again, I'll do this.
Another way, 20 years.
This movie is 2.5 hours long.
Is the joke that I made is I do want to actually pull out a stopwatch for the whole thing and figure out time to explosion, which is what is the longest gap of time between an explosion in the whole thing. Because I'm willing to bet that it is not more than 10 minutes. I think I think that'd be long.
That's pushing it. Worldwide, this film made $500 million.
What was its budget?
Budget was $140 million.
I mean, that's okay. That's still good.
No, no, it's absolutely it made back its entire budget and marketing budget.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. And, you know, and everyone, you know, I'm sure all these the lead actors got rich, except for the people who got killed off really early.
I think that one of my favorite parts is Billy Bob Thornton's performance. He's the NASA director.
Okay. Okay.
So
okay.
And he gives no shits about what's happening.
Okay. Okay. So.
Okay.
Okay. I was going to say okay.
Okay. In Apollo 13, yes. A fantastic film. And in other realistic films, you see a role of Capcom, which is the head of communications. And it is very important that there is only one person ever talking to a crew. You see that in Apollo 13. You don't see the flight director, Gene. You don't ever see him talk to the astronauts. He always talks to the Capcom guy who relays the information to the astronaut. It's a thing about clear communication.
What is Cap stand for?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Capital Communications.
That's a good question. Wade will look it up now as I talk. And in this film, it seems that it's just an open mic. You just pick up the phone. Who cares who you are? Just pick up the phone and talk to him.
Liv Tyler's shouting, giving commands.
Daddy. Capsule communicator.
There you go.
That's what it
okay,
is.
Okay, got it.
Okay, right. Yep. So yeah, it's one person. Like, and the other thing that Wade was pointing out the whole film, the lighting. In
lighting's
NASA
fucking
is,
terrible.
You look at the, like oh you need God. Light. Like they lit it like, they lit it like Michael
who
Bay
could,
would light it.
Who That's could, it's all blue lights. It's all dramatic. Like one side of your face is lit by a blue light. Who would like? Could you guys imagine if this was lit like NASA right now? I'd leave the room.
You wouldn't be able to read anything. Yeah. And like I'm assuming the people in the room have to like look at stuff. Yeah. And it's like I can't see it.
I would imagine the people in the room have to leave the room, like, to go into the hallway like, to read it and then go back inside.
You know how Apple does night shift where if it's darker your screen turns warmer so it's more easy to look at? Mm-hmm. They did the opposite. They made it darker and really bright blue.
Yeah. And some green. For no reason.
A little bit of green.
But at times, like, so there were green things in there. I think, like, the countdown timer wasn't green. But there were a couple of shots when it's just, like, it's as if they took it off the ceiling and they held it 3 inches away from the person. And I was also making a comment, like, I did lighting design during college, and I did it professionally after college for a bit for theater. And green is not a good color. It is not. It does not look good. You know, there are very specific reasons why you would want to use green, but it overall, it's not a particularly good color. It comes across weird. It makes people look weird. It does weird things to skin tones, and they just shot that green light all over Billy Bob Thornton, and in the very next shot, it's gone.
It's like they realize their mistake.
So he's the NASA director. He's in charge of this mission, and his performance the entire time is just deadpan. Doesn't care. I swear, I said this during the movie. It feels like he was secretly about to quit a week before all this happened, like quit NASA. And he's like, oh, God, now I got to deal with this.
It was like he was going to retire.
It's two days from retirement.
Shit. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, and then he's got the great scene of when everything's hitting the fan on the asteroid, the dramatic cup mug breaking.
Yo. that was
beautiful. Michael Bay loves his just dramatic, over-the-top emotional reaction moments, and there's a lot of them in this movie.
Well, I feel like the whole movie is just that. I mean, there is no breathing in this movie.
No. Not even the dialogue scenes. Yeah. It's just like back and forth.
And also with that, wanted to think of, you know, the movement of a camera, pans, tilts, dollies, trucks, all that kind of thing. When you use those particular moves, it's very important. And I don't think there was a single shot where the camera stood still. This whole thing. Like there's his classic low swoop shot of like, geez, I know like people tend to look a little bit better when you're looking up. Wait, yes. If you're looking up at them, you tend to look a little better in the shots.
Well, it depends what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're talking about flattering the face, it's slightly above. Okay, you don't get that double chin.
That's right.
Why
okay.
When you take a selfie, like, here, it's ugly.
Sorry, that slightly above shot. And he is just nonstop. It's always a boom. That's what that's the sound in my head. When it does a swooping low on a telephoto lens.
Does drop. That?
Boom.
Yeah.
When and then we just boom. And then it's like when Michael Bay was in South Park.
Yeah.
And then we and then an 18-wheeler comes in.
Mr. Bay, those are VFX shots. But it's a thing, and also with telephoto lenses, and not all of those particular shots were done with the telephoto lens, but the thing that does also, it compresses space. It flattens everything. You know, when you start to get to especially the really long telephotos, like you stop being able to tell how deep a scene is. Mm-hmm. Like if you put on like a 200 millimeter lens and you put Wade, you know, in front of camera and then you put me 50 feet behind him, it becomes very hard to tell how far away I am.
Yeah. The only shots I think he did that was the slow walking up on the tarmac.
Yes, he did that, but I think some of the swoop and when it's a shorter zoom, it doesn't look quite as compressed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I think those swoop low shots, I think a lot of them are telephoto.
Steve Buscemi stole the show, definitely.
No one else could have done it.
A lot of names in this movie that were just like strange. Like, I mean,
that's why the budget was so much.
Well, like a lot of these.
And also why they had to kill off a bunch of them. You know, they couldn't afford to keep paying Owen Wilson. They had a budget margin to match. So they need to kill him off as soon as possible.
A lot of these actors have like movies all to their own, like Owen Wilson for like one of them. And like, he's just like, it almost kind of feels like an extended cameo.
And you did also notice that all the people who die in it on the asteroid are all people that you did not see in the opening scene on the oil rig. Everyone on there survived. Except like Max. Oh yeah, except for Bruce Willis.
And Russian space station.
Yeah. But all the oil rig guys, like, oh, bring my Owen Wilson guy and bring in the Max, the guy with no weight limit.
Yep.
And the other thing, like, all those people are the ones who died, the people you did not see in the opening scene on the oil rig where they brought a shotgun.
Why
they brought a shotgun onto an oil rig?
Owen Wilson there. Like, did you hear a story at all? Was he like
he was a cowboy?
Guy, he's a cowboy. Is this guy? No, he's at a ranch.
I think a lot of those guys used to be like old miners or old drillers with Bruce.
No.
Just like, yeah, these are my guys. Like, I work with them.
In it, he says it's like, you know, I work with the best. And like when like a drill is called off. Then they sort of tend to go everywhere. So I think the idea being, is how I interpreted it, was that a lot of the people we didn't see in the initial one, they may have been on other drill sites or already on a vacation.
Sure.
And so it's like, he is not working with all the exact same people all the time. That's what I took it as.
Like freelance life.
So Steve Buscemi's character's name was Rockhound?
Yep, because he's horny.
Isn't that like rocks? Like a cocaine. That
was
the
I quote. That was a quote. That was a quote.
Halfway through this movie, it's just this gratuitous strip club scene.
Yeah, in a church. It looks like it's in a church.
That looked like a Victoria's Secret ad. That
kind of did. Yeah, the lighting was very reminiscent of something like that. Michael Bay loves three things that are consistent on his films. He loves his, you know, his angles, his low angles, and all that. The color of the films are very similar, like Transformers and Pearl Harbor and this. They're oversaturated. They have that amber and cool look. And then
America. And he loves America.
For sure.
He loves America.
Maybe four things.
Sexualized women?
That's two. Okay, maybe way more. But that was the third thing I was going to bring up was locations. So like we saw, I think it was like a train station get blown up. I swear I've seen that in Transformers and probably the island as well.
Well, I even commented like the mission control looked like that same mission control room in Transformers too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like how, okay, so on the subject of sexuality, so there's one woman in the crew. She's the no-nonsense broad who likes to just go and get stuff done. Yep. So at the end of the movie, they're trying to jumpstart the shuttle, get off the rock that's going to blow up, and she's trying to fix the engine. And the Russian space station guy gets so frustrated, he picks her up and throws her across the room and then starts hitting the terminal with a wrench and it starts working.
Yep.
That's so bad.
Michael Bay is just like,
women don't know how to do anything.
How a man gets it done.
It's
just
a man's
starts
world.
So terrible.
Banging on it. So, you know, pretty progressive commentary here. In
oh, absolutely.
Film.
Absolutely.
It was a super dumb movie, just in general. Yeah. And it's like, it was 98, but it's like, things have changed so much.
Well, what's such a shame because, like, you look at other times, you know, before, it's not like there weren't some, like, you know, it wasn't fantastic by any stretch, but there were good representations of women before this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just made it a lot worse.
I think this film dropped the ball. You know, it could have named so many new ailments. It came up with space dementia.
Yep.
It could have had space anything. Just put space in front of it.
Space AIDS.
I got a space AIDS.
Yeah, space AIDS. Not again. Yeah, Rockhound got space AIDS. That like super sexualized.
Like
guy.
Rockhound is going crazy and just shooting the Gatling gun. They brought a Gatling gun, by the way.
Oh yes.
For some reason.
Why?
Gatling guns.
Yep.
That was so dumb.
Yeah, I was surprised there were no aliens references. Like. Like maybe that's why they had mini guns up there. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
maybe.
But so he starts going crazy and shooting a Gatling gun.
Sure.
and Bruce Willis has to tackle him to the ground. He's like, "Snap out of it!" And then one of the captains is like, "He's got space dementia."
Which more than likely, the more logical thing they should have said is, "There's something wrong with his suit. He has oxygen deprivation, or he is getting CO2 because one thing that happens with high CO2 levels, as we know from Apollo 13, high CO2 levels can lead to delusions and hallucinations.
That would have made too much sense, though.
I know.
Well, I think like, a lot of it's just like that space fantasy that you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
And, like, basically, Michael Bay just comes up and like, wouldn't this be cool? And like, yeah, but it doesn't really make sense. We'll make it sense.
Yeah. make it make sense.
Make it sense. What? just do it, Mr. Earl Bay. What? You.
also,
okay, that's a shirt. I need that on a shirt and make it.
Amazing.
When someone like, and I'm at a gas station, they're like, that'll be 99 cents. Put a dollar down. Make it sense. So I also love the president character in this movie because he's just a placeholder. He's not even a real character.
Right.
And so NASA and the military is giving him all this information in the very opening 5 minutes of the film. And then he's just like, so what does it mean? Blah, blah, blah. End of the world. My God.
My God.
I'm so happy in the first 5 minutes we got it. My God.
My God.
So good.
This whole movie just kind of felt of propaganda. Like, for how many... it could be
was
like
he
a great
paid by the U.S. government?
Game.
Can we see if they're in the... Can we look at the budget? Did he get a check for
paid
him
by
to
the
put an American?
It would be a great drinking game to just kind of like drink whenever you see an American flag or just like...
No, see, you say
I do
that.
Play that.
You guys say that, but I swear, I think you guys will be dead in 3 minutes. I do not think
minutes.
You would... I think you have three
like,
minutes.
He's not even... David's
okay.
Not.
Okay. No. After this, we're gonna go and we're gonna watch the first 10 minutes of it, and we're gonna count how many flags are, and we're gonna see if you guys would be dead.
I totally forgot about this. There's a gratuitous amount of cutaways to like the wholesome American family with a flag, to the point where it straight up looks like a propaganda movie. I thought they had a lot in Transformers and Pearl Harbor, but I think this movie really does take it.
Yep. And one thing I also want to bring up with this is a comparison, because this is a movie I know you've seen, I've seen, I don't know about YouTube, but another movie that came out before this one called Deep Impact with Morgan Freeman and Elijah Wood, a very young Elijah Wood in it.
Oh, yeah.
Another, you know, a similar, very, almost, well, pretty much the exact same story. Mm-hmm. You know, Elijah Wood, the kid, as he's like 13 or something in this movie. He doesn't go into space. But, I was trying to know who is the astronaut crew. There's someone famous in that crew. But anyway, same kind of concept. Big asteroid coming in. They're going to send up a ship to fix with it. And Wade was talking about, you remember seeing that one. And then like, oh, like, and that was sort of, again, there's a lot of jumps in logic about how that works. And then like, oh, Armageddon is coming and it's going to be done right. And then
I saw a promo for it at the local theater, and I just thought, because they had a really cool ominous countdown for when the movie's going to come out, as in like the world's going to end on this whatever. Yep. And I was like, you know what? Deep Impact was kind of just a dumb popcorn movie, but maybe this is going to have some really good science and be clever. Yep. All right. And then I saw it and I was like, oh God. And I was 10 years old at this point.
Yep.
But I'm just reading some of the famous quotes. I forgot the opening scene is a narration on the dinosaurs dying.
There were three openings. There were three openings of that movie. They were working on the space station. And then
there's New York.
Then New York, and it's like,
and then and
Eddie
then,
Griffin was there with a dog, and it's like, why is this happening?
And then after that is the oil rig, the fourth opening, when we actually meet a character that we care about.
Yeah.
And a character we're supposed to care about.
So, have you guys seen the Super Mario Brothers movie?
Oh, yeah. Goombas. No. Hell yeah.
Yeah. So, do you remember the opening? It's basically the same thing. It starts with like, this is Earth when dinosaurs roamed, that sort of thing.
I don't remember it. No.
Okay. Because that's basically how this movie starts.
Yep.
Well, that's the first line of the narration. This is the Earth.
Do a voice, please.
A voice?
It's an ominous voice. Please, come on.
No. I'm doing it how they would in Super Mario Brothers.
Oh.
This is the Earth at a time when the dinosaurs roamed a lush and fertile planet. From behind the camera, a giant asteroid appears, speeding towards the Earth ahead of it. A piece of rock just 6 miles wide changed all that.
Yeah. Thank you, Ben.
By the way, J.J. Abrams.
It was a writer.
Co-writer. Yeah.
I'd like to, I want to interview him about it. I want to know what he thinks.
Because it was him and Jonathan Hensley?
Of Armageddon, not Mario Brothers.
Yes.
Who also wrote...
With a couple of Star Wars references in there, too. Already, like, seeing that J.J. Abrams was already kind of, like, trying to gear up, get himself...
That was his way. He was, like, getting into the subconscious of society.
Yeah.
But, you know, they say most of directing is casting. I think casting Bruce Willis was probably the best decision. Because could you see anyone else
really
in that role?
The only decision.
Vin Diesel.
But I mean, like... Bruce Willis Liam and his Neeson. And his squint, his just like smirk squint that he does.
Yeah,
I mean,
In all honesty, the only casting that I think was I'll probably give it to you. Bruce Willis was a logical casting for it. The only other one is Steve Buscemi. I don't like his character is ridiculous, and the number of times they make the joke of she didn't tell me her age If you had a drinking game on that, you'd be dead and halfway through.
It's not that many. It's like three.
I think you could swap Bruce Willis with Sylvester Stallone and still make this movie work.
Oh, it would be improved, I would think.
Drooling is a science.
It's an art. Oh my God. Not a science.
You just hear bubbling science. The entire time.
It's not.
It's not.
What?
Who thought of you?
His translator, Mr. Stallone, thinks that you should.
God. I always thought of you as my son. Yeah. Oh, jeez. I wish you'd just call me daddy.
Dim's got about a space dimension going. Yeah,
he's. We need to get.
I'm gone.
We need
guys,
to get him out of here.
So gone.
So okay. So to wrap up. Oh, one last thing. When Bruce Willis finally has to, spoiler alert, he stays behind to blow up the asteroid.
Wait, what?
Yeah, 20 years ago.
Missed that part. I was crying.
Yeah, so when he finally pushes the button, it's like this big dramatic swell with the music. Then it cuts to a huge close-up of his daughter's eye opening, and then it's like this.
It
really,
goes into her eye.
It's this like flash frame montage thing, really quick cut.
A
of
montage
like
montage within a month.
Of footage like, of, we've but never it, seen before. Yeah,
it's his memories, though.
Yeah.
It's footage of Bruce Willis doing like the cross on his chest, like this. And that then happened? and then Liv Tyler's doing it, and she's like got like heaven light on her.
What? I missed that. What was I doing?
You weren't living.
And then it cuts. And then it cuts to like these memories of her. And then it's just, oh God, the music. It's the best part
his
of the movie by far.
Flash before.
Yeah,
his eyes.
That's what it is.
Yep.
Yeah.
Very literally. And so, I'm sorry, Bruce Willis didn't have that great a life. Just saying.
I recommend this movie wholeheartedly. Definitely watch it with friends and be drinking. What about you guys?
What's the 24 pack?
Yeah.
I think it's gonna be in. I think the last time I watched this movie was probably in high school. It was probably about 10 years ago. If I go another 10 without seeing it, it'll be too soon.
I think it's like worth watching this movie to see how to like not make movies. I mean, there's like so many, like at least like in the modern era, there's like so many things that you just shouldn't do that were done in Armageddon. I mean, I don't know.
Bruce Willis called a bunch of people retards.
Yeah, I mean, this movie was clearly made to like make like a good like return on your buck. Kind
are
of,
you
know?
Are you saying that Michael Bay was only concerned with motherfucking money?
I make that dollar, y'all.
In America, absolutely. I mean.
But fuck he was it. Also ahead of the curve trying to cater to international audiences like a lot of films mm-hmm. are nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, with like some nice B-roll. Like, let's
yeah.
just toss
of like,
in.
That's yeah. totally true. Yeah.
No, yeah.
And he showed, I think it was Shanghai getting blown up. Yeah, you got to cater to the Chinese audience too, bro.
That's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kellen, would you recommend seeing Armageddon?
I would. I would recommend watching Armageddon, but then also going on, watch the music video.
Yeah.
And then also go on
don't want to miss the thing.
Yeah, yep. Go on IMDb and just look at like the photos and just look and see the people at the time. Because you're like, of course this movie got made. Why would it not get made? Like before it was The Rock and then like mm-hmm. Con Air, mm-hmm. Bad yep. Boys. Like it was just action filth. Yeah. So mm-hmm.
Con action Air is a filth. Great movie. You take that back.
It is. I mean, any action movie that's like has
Nick
that many.
Nick Cage.
Oh yeah, Nick Cage. Oh my God. Yeah.
Hummingbird.
And Steve Buscemi's in that one too, right?
He is.
Yeah, yeah. He plays a creepy guy.
He's the psycho killer.
The same character.
He had severe space dementia in that one.
Mm-hmm. Steve Buscemi is a game typecaster, I tell you.
Yeah. Okay, well, we all wholeheartedly recommend it then. Great. Sounds good.
Great.
Great.
Well, thank you so much, guys, for indulging me in watching this movie. It was
next month, we'll watch something better.
We Deep will.
And that's not it. That's not true at all. And if you see anything in theaters, that's not going to be good.
we'll come back with a robust podcast with many different twists and turns. In the meantime,
unlike that film we just watched.
In the meantime, Armageddon out of here.
Oh, Dad.
Fuck.
I don't want to close my eyes. Don't want to fall asleep because I'd miss you, babe. And I don't want to miss a thing because even when I'm with you,
I don't want to tell
something. Enough of that. Oh, God, my ears.